Don't try to deny it. Do you imagine that's the case for Dr. Vritet?
Safadi shivered. No, she wouldn't like to be trying to do science on Romulus, not even before this. Science depended on being open, on sharing results, and being willing to accept when you had made mistakes. Were Romulan scientists allowed to work that way? Were they allowed to make mistakes? Particularly when their work was as politically sensitive as this field had so suddenly become?
Do you think, Safadi said thoughtfully, that if I requested it, there'd be any chance of going to see Vritet, to work with him and his people on their modeling? See if they've missed something or we've missed something? Even to have a means to correspond with him regularly?
But Durnium was shaking her head.
You know it makes sense, and I know it makes sense, but the reality is it's not going to happen. The politics of it.
She held up her hands.
There'll be conversations at Starfleet Intelligence, you know, about whether these figures should even be released to the Romulans.
What?
Safadi was shocked. That can't be right. They have to know.
I know, but at the same time, someone will be making a calculation. What's the impact of passing this on? Will the Romulans accept the new figures? Will they lose face? Will they pull down the shutters, refuse to allow us to continue with the help we are giving them?
It's math, said Safadi simply. You can't argue with it. It's how it is.
And all we can do is be sure that our facts are straight. What other people do with those facts? That's something we can't control.
She looked steadily at the younger woman. You're sure about these figures, aren't you?
I am absolutely sure, said Safadi.
Then don't worry about what comes next.
You have done your best, and if everyone acts as they should, you'll have saved lives, Amal. How often in our field do we get to say that?
Daystrom Institute, Okinawa, Earth. Bruce Maddox couldn't ever remember a time when he enjoyed teaching. He had never imagined himself as a teacher. His desire had always been to lose himself in the lab, immerse himself in the theoretical work. What he wanted was to be left alone to work on what he had dreamed of since he was a boy when he read and watched everything he could about androids, marveling at the idea that something could look alive and yet not be alive. Then, later, hearing about Data and seeing Data, he was sure that he could build a machine like that. All he wanted was his chance. But so many things interfered. Committee meetings, peer review, examining. No wonder Noonien Soong had hidden himself away. Sometimes Maddox dreamed of leaving everything behind, dashing off into the unknown where he could be left in peace to make his breakthrough. Teaching was the worst for sucking up time and energy. Over the years, he had done his best to limit how much time he was obliged to devote to the task, and yet here he was, as the afternoon wore on, taking a group of 10 graduate students through advanced positronics. They didn't understand most of what he was saying. Of course they didn't. Maddox wasn't sure that he entirely understood himself. Only Soong had fully understood positronics. Only Soong had created a sentient android, a scientific marvel. Maddox had intended to be next. But here he was, stuck in the classroom, and as soon as he got away, he would be stuck working for LaForge. Life was short, and as the years passed, Maddox seemed to hear the clock ticking louder and louder. Sometimes he worried that his best years had gone, that his creativity was spent. Sometimes he was afraid that he had missed his chance completely, that he would never see the dream realized, see the spark of life come into the eyes of one of his creations. Other colleagues, he knew, found teaching exhilarating. Working with energetic and unformed young minds kept their own work and passion fresh and vital. But Maddox found it exhausting, constantly having to explain basic principles. Even at postgraduate level, where students had deeper understanding, he struggled to find a like mind. Sure, the kids here this afternoon were bright, but they weren't committed. They were checking off a box before being allowed to move into their specialisms. They might grasp the basics, but they didn't grasp what mattered. They didn't care. And that made this yet another monumental waste of his precious and rapidly disappearing time. But academic protocol, not to mention ethics, required that junior colleagues did not bear the burden of teaching, especially while trying to establish themselves as serious researchers. However much Maddox argued that senior staff needed this time and space in order to be able to conduct top-level research, he still ended up teaching for hours beyond what he preferred. But once the classes were over, he had always been able to go back to his desk, to his work. With relief, he would return to the intricacies and puzzles of his studies, to the elusive promise of creating synthetic, sentient life. Now even that was to be taken away. And for what? To build robots, machines, toys. It was weeks now since LaForge's visit, and between demands from him and classroom duties, Maddox had more or less given up on his research. He looked without interest at his class. They looked indifferently back. "Okay," he said. "That's enough for today." They were up from their chairs and out the door within seconds. Maddox shoved his notes into his briefcase. Back in his office, there would be questions from LaForge, messages from that damned Mackenzie. If he was lucky, he would find some time after hours to look at his own research. "Dr. Maddox?" One of the students was still hanging around. A young woman. He couldn't remember her name. He hadn't yet committed the names of all the class to memory, and he wasn't sure he would manage it before the end of the semester. He did recognize her, though. She had been sitting up front for every one of these seminars. Long, fair hair pulled back into a ponytail, wisps escaping from both sides, as if she hadn't quite remembered to fix it properly. Chewing her bottom lip. Eyes wide set and eager. Altogether, there was a freshness and energy about her that made him feel exhausted. "Yes, Ms.
Girati. Agnes Girati. It's doctor, actually. I'm a medical doctor."
"Dr. Girati, of course." Now he recalled the name. Starfleet. She'd been seconded here, part of some interdisciplinary program or other, yet another Starfleet interference. She had sent him a message titled "Potential Dissertation Subjects" that he hadn't yet opened. He picked up his briefcase and began to move toward the door. "How may I help?" She followed him.
"I was wondering whether you'd seen my message."
"I've seen it," he said.
"And I was hoping you had some thoughts? About the final project, I mean?"
She looked anxious and keen to please. He was keen to get away. He felt so damn tired by the end of the day. "I'm afraid I haven't had a chance to read in detail." She looked so crestfallen that he was faintly embarrassed. He gestured around the room. "Once teaching starts, you never seem to get on top of things." She made a rather ineffective attempt to cover her obvious deep disappointment.
"Sure, yes, of course."
She brightened and gave a wide, sweet smile.
"Are you walking back to your office? I'm heading that way. Perhaps I could sketch my ideas out to you now?"
Might be better if you set up a meeting."
"Meetings take time, Dr. Maddox. This is time you're already spending walking."
"Yes," he thought, "but walking time is thinking time, and once I'm at my desk, I'm stuck thinking about the damned toys." She trotted alongside him, still bright and hopeful. She wasn't going to take no for an answer, was she?
"Dr. Maddox," she said, "I hope this doesn't sound weird."
"Why me?" he thought.
"But I came to the Daystrom Institute to study with you. Nobody else will do. Nobody else is doing anything else worth studying. That's why I came here."
She was gazing up at him with something close to devotion.
I've been reading your work on Soong-type androids. It's brilliant. It's what I want to do. You're the reason I'm here.
She held out her hands.
Please, hear me out. While you walk back to your office.
Brilliant, gifted people are no different from the rest of us. Subject to doubt, susceptible to flattery. Bruce Maddox was, after all, only human, and hardly the perfect creation of his imagination. He ushered the young woman out of the lecture room ahead of him, turned off the lights, and closed the door. He stood in the corridor and looked at the hope in her eyes.
I've been talking for a while now, he said. How about we go and get a coffee?
Her eyes shone. Oh, I'd love that.
It was past 5 o'clock. Outside, the day was darkening, though it was still warm enough for him to carry his jacket. They ended up, inevitably, in the campus coffee house. She got iced coffee in a tall glass. He got green tea. As they were heading to the table, she suddenly backed up and ran to the counter to replicate a pile of chocolate chip cookies.
Sorry, she said, already biting into one
as she sat down opposite him.
Your class bends my brain, and I get so hungry afterward. You want anything?
She hadn't stopped talking since the classroom, and the cookies weren't slowing her down. She explained how she had read nearly everything he had written, and he realized that she spoke with real understanding. She also spoke with her hands. She almost knocked over her tall glass of iced coffee as she talked about his last article. When they both reached out to steady the glass, their hands brushed against each other. She laughed, and so did he. She was cute. But he had to put a stop to this, and now. If only she had walked in 5 years ago. 10.
Dr. Girardi, I'm okay with first names, you know.
She flushed.
I mean, as long as you are.
Agnes, he said. I've enjoyed hearing you speak. It's been...
He laughed again.
It's been a joy, to be honest.
She grinned. She had a small smear of chocolate on her left cheek.
Hey, me too.
But I'm afraid I'm not taking on any students right now.
Her face fell. He felt like he'd kicked a puppy. Was she capable of concealing any emotion? Everything was immediately out there.
Excuse me?
I'm not taking on any students right now.
For a moment, he was afraid she was going to cry.
But it's not as if I was talking about doctoral work. This is the final project for this semester, and there's nobody else that I would want. I mean, I'm not even going to be here next semester. I'm going back to Starfleet.
Agnes.
Why? Why not?
10 years ago, he thought. 5. They could have worked together blissfully without disturbance. He imagined what it might have been like, having a student who truly understood his work and didn't treat him as nothing more than a gateway to a necessary credit. Would it have made the difference, having someone to discuss his work with? Maybe they would have made the breakthrough, the elusive breakthrough. All this time working alone. And now, here she was, and the damn Romulan sun had chosen one hell of a time to go supernova. His tea had gone cold. He pushed the cup away. He hadn't wanted it in the first place. Because I'm not working in that field any longer.
What do you mean?
I'm not working on positronics any longer.
Her mouth fell open into a shocked O.
You've not given up, have you? You can't. I can't believe you'd give up.
Yes, he said bitterly. Then, no, I've not given up. I've been made to give up.
Who?
She said.
Who's making you give up? You can't be made to give up your life's work.
I'm afraid I can, he said. Or to be fair, I can be asked by someone I admire and respect to do something so time-consuming and so necessary that I won't be able to carry on with my own research.
What can be more important than what you're doing? Damn it, you're trying to create life!
He began to laugh, not unkindly, but from the simple pleasure of hearing someone else say what he had only ever heard inside his own head. He fell back in his chair.
Oh, Agnes, he said. I wish you'd turned up years ago. We could have done something special.
We still can.
Did she know how cute she looked? Her face covered in chocolate chip cookie, her eyes bright with indignation? No, of course she didn't. The obliviousness was part of the charm.
What are you being made to do?
He glanced around the room. You know, some of the things we do here don't need to be widely broadcast. She went scarlet. She put her hand over her mouth.
Oh, I am so sorry.
Don't worry, but no, I'm the one who is sorry. I wish I could, but I can't. It's not possible. He drank the rest of his cold tea and stood up. I'm sorry. She jumped up, grabbing her pad from the table.
But I hadn't even started to explain my idea.
He put up his hands to stop her. He didn't want to hear what she had to say. What if it turned out to make sense? What if it turned out to be the one thing that could have made a difference? I can't work with you, Dr. Girardi.
Look, she said. Have you ever considered the capabilities of a single positronic neuron?
He wavered, but no, he couldn't allow this. I'm shifting focus now, he said. I'm working on bioneural circuitry.
She looked baffled. That's a big shift. Why would you be working on something like that all of a sudden?
I told you, it's what's needed right now.
He saw her brow furrow, watched the cogwheels of her brain shift and turn. Hey, they've been working on that on Mars, haven't they? For shipbuilding?
He saw her come to an understanding. Geez, she was sharp.
Oh, I see.
Yes, well, can you remember that it's not to be discussed widely, and we're in a campus coffee house?
Oh, of course.
She took a step toward him.
But that doesn't make any difference, does it?
It's an entirely different field.
So?
So?
So you can work on both at once.
He stopped dead. Excuse me?
Excuse me? You're Bruce Maddox. You're the galaxy's living expert on synthetic life. You can work on both at once.
Her excitement was gathering momentum.
Why not? Maybe they come down to the same thing. Maybe there's something that will unify these technologies.
She began to laugh.
I don't know. You're the expert. You're the genius.
Genius, he thought. Then, hey, why the hell not?
You're the person to find out, though, aren't you?
She reached over to touch him very gently on the wrist.
Aren't you, Bruce?
Yes, he thought. I am. He reached out to touch her cheek, to wipe the smear of chocolate away. She blushed when she realized what he was doing. They met the following day, mid-morning, at the same place. He watched in awe as she demolished two slices of carrot cake with cream cheese frosting. She talked about her project. The next day she came to his office and she talked about his last paper. The day after that she came to his home. This time, he even got to do some talking. He explained more about the work he was doing with Mackenzie and why. She was enthralled. He thought, perhaps it's worth doing after all. And then she said,
but it's not your life's work, is it? Never mind. I promise you, Bruce, you can have it all.
He didn't take her seriously. Not really. He knew she was going back to Starfleet soon, and he would go back to the damned toys. He asked her to go for coffee again after the next seminar. He watched her put away a giant slice of cake and found himself smiling at her enthusiasm. She was leaving soon. Surely they could simply enjoy each other's company, each other's intelligence, in the meantime? What harm was there in keeping each other company?
No harm.
4. Admiral's log. We are 36 hours out from Ectis 2, when the process of relocating its population can at last get underway.
All the advice given me by experts in the field of refugee relocation has indicated one thing, that after months of planning, our preparations, however meticulous, will most likely still not be sufficient for the specific task at hand. We shall see what happens 2 days from now. Certainly, we have done all that we can. The journey here has not been wasted, and the accommodations for our guests are in excellent order. We have brought the full fleet of 15 ships to Ectis. Commander LaForge reports to me that the refitting of an additional 8 ships will be ready in 6 days, and these can proceed to Tavares 6. That mission, commanded by Captain Nangala on the Patience, is becoming increasingly urgent. Tavares is a partially terraformed world just outside the Romulan system. The terraforming process there was at a critical stage, and with the withdrawal of the resources, there have been severe and unanticipated effects. Rafi, through whatever official or unofficial channels she receives this information, has obtained footage of flash flooding in several towns, leaving thousands homeless and dispossessed. These images bring home to me the urgency of our mission, and give immediacy to what might otherwise seem too vast and impossible a task. Briefings from my science officers tell me that we can expect these effects to become more marked as the months pass. Our aim is to remove populations from their homeworlds before such calamities strike. Combining relocation efforts with on-the-ground disaster relief adds significant layers of complexity to our work. Nevertheless, I have asked Commander Bowie to set up a task force to explore and model such scenarios, to see what special equipment and personnel would be needed. Starfleet Command continues to provide whatever is needed. In my last conversation with the CNC, he asked for some positive news to take back to the Federation Council. We have retrofitted our ships to serve as people carriers. Geordi informs me that retrofitting of further ships is now well underway and they should join our fleet within the next 4 months. The problem of rapidly expanding the capacity of the shipyards has not yet been solved. Nevertheless, I note that Geordi's reports have of late become more effusive, and my sense is that whatever resistance he had been facing on Mars is starting to break down. Perhaps the technical challenge of this mission begins to grip the imaginations and consciences of the engineers there. If ever there was a time to set aside personal goals for a greater good, this is it. Here on the Verity, we wait for our mission to begin. We have relied upon the Romulan authorities to organize our guests. This is, according to Lieutenant Coley, precisely the kind of matter where Federation and Romulan sensibilities might not be in alignment, and offense may inadvertently be given. Left to our own devices, we would have taken the vulnerable first, children, the infirm, the elderly, and caregivers. I note from the lists that several of these groups are among the first to board. I note also the names of a large number of prominent politicians and officials. I am aware that Romulan culture is hierarchical in ways that the Federation is not. Nevertheless, I do feel some unease about the priorities implied by this order of arrival. I remain prepared for the unexpected, and am glad of the presence of Lieutenant Coley, whose experience and outlook are proving to be most useful. Verity, approaching Ectis 2. The first weeks on board ship had passed in a blur. Picard had found himself confronted with so many decisions that he was barely able to distinguish what was crucial, what was necessary, what could be deferred, and what was moot. Rafi proved his savior. She made him work out the system by which more mundane decisions were detoured to her and the various department heads, and the more crucial information filtered up to him. By the end of the first month, they had shifted from hourly briefings to 4 times daily. He was pleased with her, very pleased. The commander was confident, on top of detail, and she had a way with people that always seemed to elude him. She knew how to put them at ease. She knew how to put him at ease. "How much of the elephant did we get through today, Rafi?" he would ask at their end-of-day briefing.
A fair chunk, she would reply. But there's another herd of the bastards arriving tomorrow.
Still, the night before they were due to begin their work on Ectus, he lay in his cabin restless, sleep impossible. For the first time, he found himself missing the Enterprise. He listened to the gentle pulses of his new ship. The darkness of his room expanded in his thoughts to encompass all the empty decks of the vessel, soon to be temporary home to so many people. Doubt suddenly assailed him. This mission, so vast, so complex, was it in fact possible? To turn around the great vessel of Starfleet, to ask people to set aside their work, their lives, their goals, and sublimate everything to help not friends, but long-term enemies? How had he actually believed that he could do this? Was this not the very definition of hubris? Was Nemesis lying in wait? He longed for his old ship, the familiar routines, officers who were also friends. Had he made the worst decision of his life? Stop this, he chided himself. There were others who were sacrificing more. Rafi, he knew, although she never mentioned him, had a husband and son, whom she was presumably missing greatly. LaForge had also left the Enterprise and was trying to do a difficult task in a less-than-supportive environment. He should not be brooding. He should be grateful of the people he had around him. What did Rafi say? One bite at a time. Quite. He rolled over, listened to his XO, and finally went to sleep. In the morning, he was refreshed and calm. The senior staff from the Verity had gathered in the ship's conference room, and the captains of the other 14 ships were patched in. Top of the agenda was naturally the mission to Ectus II. 10 of the ships were to position themselves around the more populated southern hemisphere, the remaining 5 to the north. Each ship was assigned a particular urban center to which the local population had been gathered prior to Starfleet's arrival. This task had been performed by the authorities on the ground. Rafi, when he had broached his concerns about this part of the operation, had said, "If anyone can force march large numbers of people into camps, it's the Tal Shiar." He hadn't been sure whether this had been meant to make him feel better. As they ran through the mission, he saw that Koli Jokan was trying to catch his eye. She had asked to speak in this meeting. He nodded, "Yes, yes, when we are ready." She was a good advisor, although very reserved. He understood that Rafi, in between everything else, had made friendly overtures which, while not exactly rebuffed, had not brought the two women much closer than arm's length. The briefing drew to a close. Everyone seemed in good spirits, ready now for the work to begin. Some of them looked genuinely excited.
"Very good," said Picard. "Before we conclude, however, I've asked Lieutenant Coley to give us a short overview of what our mission might mean to the Romulans whom we shall be relocating. All of us, I know, have signed up for this mission out of the desire to help, out of the desire to make a difference in the face of what could be one of the greatest calamities ever to overcome a sentient species. But the desire to aid is one thing, and the efficacy of that aid is another. Lieutenant Coley, could you explain?"
Coley took her place at the head of the table. When she knew she had everyone's attention, she reached up and gently touched the long earring, a symbol of her Bajoran heritage.
"When the Cardassians arrived on Bajor," Coley said, "they came under the guise of friendship. They said they were there to offer us aid." "Well, that struck some of us as odd. We were interested in friendship, yes, although we didn't recall asking for aid. But it turned out we were going to get it, whatever our opinion on the matter."
Picard saw a couple of people stir around the table. Coley continued.
"I know. There's no direct comparison between this situation and the occupation. The Cardassians imposed their rule over Bajor by superior force. We've been invited by the Romulans to give specific assistance. Starfleet comes with open hands, offering that assistance. But we should be careful. We should be conscious of our limits and of the point where aid turns into, well, assimilation. What might seem to us like a gesture of friendship might well be perceived as overstepping the mark, particularly when dealing with a culture as closed as the Romulans. We come offering help to a long-standing enemy at a time of their weakness. They are afraid, not only of what is happening, but of what this offer of help might be concealing. What do we want in return? Do we ever intend to leave? Again, there was muttering around the table. She carried on, her voice clear and insistent. Picard found that he rather admired her. She was the only one here, he thought, with direct experience of living through a remotely comparable set of events. "Above all," she said, "we must remember that this calamity belongs to the Romulans. I say this not to give us the excuse to turn our backs, quite the contrary. But Romulan self-determination must be at the forefront of your mind. However tempting it seems, whatever heart-wrenching situations you find yourself facing over the coming days, remember, please, the Romulans must lead. We do no good if we assert our authority over theirs. We do no good if we undermine them. Work such as this is hard, my friends. The line between help and colonization is very fine, and one that we will have to walk constantly. But we serve nobody, not us, certainly not the Romulans, if we make them the beggars of two quadrants." The room was quiet. The excitement about the mission had been replaced now, not with disillusionment, but something more tempered, more considered.
"Resolve," thought Picard. "We are resolved to do this."
"Thank you, Lieutenant," he said. As she took her seat, he addressed his staff. "Words of caution are not easy to hear, but as Lieutenant Curley reminds us, nobody is served if we do not heed them."
He caught Raffi's eye.
"Lift the mood," he told her.
Raffi, as ever, delivered the goods.
"You heard them. Now get out there and bust your damn guts."
Laughing, inspired, motivated, and brilliant, his new team embarked upon their task. Verity, in orbit of Ectis II. The first day was nearly done. Picard made his way toward Deck 29, summoned there by Raffi. In the turbolift, briefly alone, he closed his eyes to gather his resources for the confrontation that he suspected was about to ensue. All had proceeded more or less as expected. No access to the planet's surface, no sight of the accommodations on the ground. Settlers, transported in groups of 20, each party accompanied by at least one Tal Shiar officer at 15-minute intervals. Handed over to two Starfleet officers who took them to their quarters and returned within the hour to take their next assigned group. He watched them arrive, party after party, frightened and silent people, clutching bags to themselves, staring around this Starfleet vessel. Some were apprehensive, some fearful, some hostile. A considerable number seemed to him to look blank, as if all emotion had already been spent. To his private grief and shame, he realized that after an hour or two, the faces had begun to blur. Still, they came. He left his staff to continue their work, returning briefly to his ready room to ask the ship's counselor to make sessions available for all staff involved. He then began his rounds of each deck, to see how well their guests were settling in, and to make sure that the various dignitaries felt they had been paid their due. Then the message had come from Raffi.
"Deck 29, please, as soon as you can. We've got a live one."
The turbolift stopped. Picard opened his eyes.
Even before the doors opened, he could hear the raised voices. He saw Rafi lurking in the corridor and went to greet her.
"Hi, JL," she said. She had found this nickname somewhere. Nobody else would get away with it. Nobody on the Enterprise would have dared. Neither dismissive nor insubordinate, and yet somehow extremely familiar and disarming. Pure Rafi.
"Rather noisy," Picard said. "I could hear the fracas from inside the turbolift."
"Guess who?" she said and made a face.
"Suvim?"
"You bet."
Picard frowned. Subpraetor Suvim had already made his presence felt from the ground via a series of self-important communiques sent directly to Picard, which had consisted of a list of requirements for the journey, and which had made clear his expectation that the Admiral would be present on his arrival. Picard's reply, polite and brief, had advised him to address his specific needs to Lieutenant Coley, and noted that he feared he would be unfortunately absent from the ship at the precise time of Suvim's arrival, being at a meeting with the governor. Picard had been inclined simply to meet the sub-praetor, but both Rafi and Coley had advised not. It was chiefly posturing on Suvim's part, and any ground given now would not be won back later. The sub-praetor had been on board now for slightly over an hour, and already there was trouble.
"What's his issue?" Picard said to Rafi as they made their way slowly down the corridor.
"You'll not believe this. The size of his quarters."
"They're standard."
"I think that might be the issue."
"I see."
"Also, we smell."
Picard turned to stare at his XO.
"I beg your pardon, Commander?"
"Apparently humans smell sour," said Rafi. "Of milk. Who would have known? All these years as part of a diverse federation of planets, and everybody has been too polite to mention that we reek of sour milk."
"I take my tea black," Picard murmured, and went to meet his guest.
Coley was there already, standing her ground in the face of a tall, elderly Romulan. Suvim, presumably. He was looming over Coley, shoulders squared, clearly trying to intimidate. Coley, to her credit, appeared not in the least daunted. Picard imagined she had faced Cardassians with the power of life and death over her. Suvim's aggression would be small change in comparison. Coley's gaze flicked from Suvim to Picard, coming along the corridor toward them. Suvim, alerted, as Coley intended, turned and snarled,
"Are you Picard?"
Picard came to stand beside Coley, a united front.
"Yes, I am Admiral Picard. A pleasure to meet you at last, Subpraetor."
Suvim growled,
"I doubt that. I'm not in the habit of pleasing Starfleet officers."
Picard looked back at him blandly.
"Is there a problem? Aside from your absence on my arrival?"
"As was explained, I was meeting the governor. She sends her greetings, by the way, and hopes to hear that your journey to Arnath goes well."
That halted Suvim briefly. The governor of Ectis II was further up the food chain from him, and he would not want to think that a bad word would get back to her.
"Well," said Suvim, his voice slightly moderated, "having now seen the quarters you expect me to use, I cannot see how that could possibly be the case."
Picard, catching sight of Rafi's face, raised an eyebrow to prevent her from saying anything. Hours had been spent on precisely this, of course, making sure that the space available to each person was comfortable, while still taking into account the sheer number of bodies to be transported. And then there was the intense Romulan need for privacy, bordering on the paranoid, which, it turned out, was paramount in their domestic living spaces, and made the open plan arrangements generally favored by Starfleet on their ships out of the question. Each new internal wall took away precious centimeters of space that could be devoted to saving one more life.
"I'm sorry to hear these are unsatisfactory," said Picard in his calmest, most measured tone.
the voice he used to placate the ruffled feathers of the most aggrieved visitor, respond to threats from the captains of hostile ships, quell uprisings, and so on. The trick was to make the other person sound loud in comparison. Even if they didn't consciously register, they subconsciously got the impression that they were being noisy and unreasonable.
We're aware, of course, that the corridors will need considerable work before we take on board more guests.
Suvim, wrong-footed, blinked. Coley had already raised the issue of the corridors, and this had been passed along to the designers at Utopia Planitia. The internal walls of the decks on ships not yet in production could certainly be redesigned along more agreeable lines. It was a known issue, and therefore could be offered as a face-saving point in their conversation.
Yes, the corridors, said Suvim,
gesturing toward the corner that led back to the turbolift.
I have no idea who might be coming that way.
There are no known hostiles on board, said Picard.
I am on a Starfleet vessel, Admiral, said Suvim.
Picard was prepared to concede, inwardly at least, that Suvim had a point. It would be easy for us to arrange a security device there, Sub-Praetor, operated from within your quarters so that you could check regularly on foot traffic along the corridor outside. Not that there is likely to be much. We have, as requested, assigned you quarters in a quieter area of the ship.
And then there are the quarters themselves, said Suvim.
Rafi whispered in Picard's ear,
Oh, this should be good. Sub-Praetor Suvim, said Coley, believes that his quarters are too small.
Suvim turned back toward the door of his quarters.
Well, of course he does,
muttered Rafi, traipsing behind, earning warning glances from both Coley and Picard. Picard stood in the middle of the room and looked around. He could see nothing wrong. The additional partitions made the space rather claustrophobic, yes, and he himself would certainly prefer something that gave as much illusion of space as possible, but otherwise all was clean, neat, and comfortable.
As I understand it, Picard said, you are the sole occupant of these rooms. What difference does that make?
You do know, said Rafi, that we have a lot of people to move.
Suvim turned to her, eyes flashing. But Coley, who had moved farther into the quarters and was now standing by a small cabinet, said,
Excuse me, Sub-Praetor, but may I ask you a question?
Distracted, he turned to her.
What is it?
Isn't this the Star Medal, given for conspicuous bravery during the defense of Alea?
Picard, watching Suvim melt, thanked Coley's prophets for her presence.
Yes, said Suvim, reaching for his honor. It is.
You know, said Coley, the Bajoran people have always been grateful for the support the Romulans gave during the Dominion War. What was your involvement at the Battle of Alea?
Rafi's comm badge sounded, and she went outside to take the message. When she returned, she said,
Admiral, Governor Menema would like to speak to you at your earliest availability.
Picard turned back to Suvim.
If you'll excuse me, Sub-Praetor, I shall leave you in Lieutenant Coley's capable hands.
Suvim absently waved a hand in dismissal. Picard and Rafi beat a hasty retreat. As they walked together back to the turbolift, Picard pushed out a breath.
Thank you for the rescue.
Thank Coley, she said. Menema does want to talk to you, though. I gather there's a problem with her replicator.
They entered the turbolift.
Deck 24, said Rafi. Do you think all our problems will be this mundane?
Let us hope so.
I mean, what did they expect from a refugee ship?
Picard pondered how it must feel to have to leave one's home, to be forced to fit the meager possessions allowed into a few small rooms.
I mean, we're not a hotel, Rafi grumbled.
I think that perhaps they have not entirely come to terms with their status, Rafi.
I think that in Suvim's case, that's very charitable of you, J.L.
She shook her head.
We'll be choosing cushion covers next.
Institute of Astronomy, Cambridge, Earth. Durnham offered to lead the meeting with Starfleet Intelligence, but Safadi said no. The figures were hers. She should be the one to defend. But she was glad of Durnham's presence beside her, the introduction of my excellent colleague, Dr. Safadi, and then the encouraging look as Safadi rose to her feet and began her presentation. Durnham nodded throughout, too, signaling her confidence in the figures being presented and that the underlying datasets were sound and the modeling and analysis were solid. At the table, a specialist from Romulan Affairs, Lieutenant Haig, sat scribbling detailed notes, looking up every so often to frown at the display. On the view screen at one end of the room, patched in from the relief mission's flagship, the starship Verity, Commander Rafi Musiker sat chin in hand and eyes half closed. She looked exhausted. For a brief moment, Safadi thought the commander had fallen asleep. No. The commander might be tired, but was listening to every single word. Safadi wound up her presentation with three key points. Based on these figures, the speed with which the star was progressing toward its explosive end was greatly accelerated, and that the impact on the blast radius needed to be increased accordingly. And last of all, well, Safadi had saved the worst until last.
And this has serious implications for the relief mission as currently planned.
She glanced over at Musiker.
This isn't only math, you see. It has direct consequences for your mission, Commander. Some of the worlds we previously thought were safe, they're now within the blast range. You can't relocate people to them. Worse than that, you now have to shift anyone already there.
Musiker lifted her head from her hand.
I'm not even going to pretend I understand the calculations underneath all of this, and I don't want to imply anything improper, but how do I know I haven't made a mistake?
Musiker smiled.
You took the words right out of my mouth.
Well, anything's possible, of course, said Safadi. We're flawed human beings, after all, and one impeccable bullion, but we are very good at what we do.
I don't understand why the figures have been revised upwards so significantly.
Because our previous model was based on figures supplied by the Romulans, said Durnham. This is based on our own readings.
In which case I do understand, said Musiker. All right, I'll take these figures to the Admiral. Looks like we're going to have to do some reprioritizing. But in the meantime, is there anything else we can do to bridge this gap between their figures and ours? Haig, are the Romulans giving us anything?
Haig said, We can't force them to give us information, Rafi. You know that as well as anyone. They're Romulans. They're left hands.
Yeah, I know. But this discrepancy is going to cause us major problems, I can guarantee you, and we need as much evidence as we can get.
Durnham caught Safadi's eye.
Quick, ask. There is one thing, said Safadi. Oh, yeah? The expert on this, on Romulus, is a scientist called Nokim Vritet. If I could speak to him somehow, show him my data, my modeling.
Haig said, As if that's ever going to happen.
Musiker, too, looked skeptical.
They're not exactly issuing visas these days, Dr. Safadi. No, so I'd like to issue him an invitation to come and visit us here at Cambridge, in the spirit of cross-cultural communication, that kind of thing.
Musiker and Haig exchanged glances.
A Romulan scientist on Earth?
And his half-dozen Tal Shiar handlers.
Haig shrugged.
I suppose we can issue an invitation. Is there any way we can make it less obvious?
Durnham, leaning forward, said,
Symposium.
What's that? Said Musiker.
It's a small gathering, said Safadi. Usually experts in a specific field, addressing a particular topic.
Like a conference, said Durnham bluntly, but less hassle.
Do you think they'd let him come?
If I'm being honest?
Haig shook his head.
Probably not. But if we issue the invitation in such a way that they would lose face to refuse, we might get someone sent. Probably Tal Shiar, but at the very least, informed enough to be able to sound like they know what they're talking about. Of course, they'll be trying to get information from us.
It's scientific data, said Safadi. Freely available. Open access. All they have to do is ask. Once I publish, they won't even have to do that.
Safadi became aware that Musiker was studying her closely.
Was there something you wanted to ask me, Commander?
Yeah, actually. Do you mind, Dr. Safadi, having your research used in this way?
Safadi glanced at Dernium, who shrugged. You mean to form policy about the mission? No, of course not. That's one of the reasons we do the work we do.
Actually, I meant used as an excuse to invite the Tal Shiar to Earth and have Haig here and his team follow them around.
Hey, Rafi, said Haig. That isn't fair.
Honest question. I don't want to piss them off. We need them on our side.
Safadi thought about that. The work they did here, it was so arcane.
Watching her mother try to explain to her friends what her daughter did was hilarious.
Whatever she does, she's doing it now in Cambridge,
Mama would say firmly, closing down any further questioning.
Safadi didn't pretend she was wise in the ways of intelligence agencies, but she wanted to help. I'm thinking about Nokim Vritet, she said at last. Science is about communication, the free exchange of ideas. It must be lonely working the way he does. Must have got lonelier ever since his work became so critical. I'd like him to be able to come. I'd like to be able to meet him, talk to him. She smiled. Besides, Cambridge is nice in the spring.
Then let's try it. The Tal Shiar will definitely want to come too, though. I hear they like visiting ancient cultural centers. I know that's why I joined the intelligence services.
Okay, I've got yet another meeting that started 20 minutes ago, and I want to brief the Admiral on this first. Haig, let's catch up later. Verity out.
Well, said Dernium, it seems we have a symposium to arrange.
With spies, said Safadi. That's very Cambridge.
Yes, well, let's leave all that to the people who know what they're doing.
Dernium gave her a faint smile.
Did you ever think, Amal, that what we did would suddenly become the most politically charged field of study in 2 quadrants?
Safadi smiled back.
As long as my mother sees me on the Hollow News, said Safadi, it'll be worth it.
Verity. Picard took Rafi's news with equanimity.
People told me, he said when she finished, to plan for the unexpected. And here it is. How is the discrepancy between figures explained?
Original estimates were based on datasets supplied by the Romulans.
You need say no more.
It must have killed them to give us even that much.
Picard said,
Do you think they know already?
Rafi sighed.
If they didn't, they will when Safadi publishes her paper.
She leaned forward to speak more quietly.
I think they must have known, J.L. There's been spotty but steady intelligence suggesting they've been understating the effects of the blast. I'd taken it to mean that they were downplaying the impact of relocation so that people would move willingly. Well, perhaps it meant something else all along. Either way, our people at Romulan Affairs are informing Federation Affairs before Safadi goes public.
Speaking about the impact of the news, Picard asked, are we concerned about this information reaching the Romulan on the street, as it were? This news is likely to be a significant blow to morale.
Coley would tell you that that's an internal Romulan affair, and she'd be right.
Picard was content to concede that point. One less thing to worry about.
Besides, said Rafi, the average Romulan isn't going to hear the first thing about it.
How can they prepare themselves? Picard said.
if they have no idea.
Typical Romulan secrecy. Riddles wrapped in enigmas.
But at the cost of saving lives, Rafi?
Rafi shrugged.
Not much about the Romulans makes sense, JL. They're working from different fundamental principles from us. They're bizarre and sneaky. Given the choice between what's coming from our astronomers and what the Tal Shiar is telling us, I know which I'd pick. And that means we need to think through the ramifications for the mission. The difference between 9.7 and 10 may sound small, but not when you're talking light years. 10 more worlds.
Those concentric rings, Picard thought as they looked through Safadi's new model. They seemed to fan out farther every time he looked at them, each new wave bringing a host of implications, social, political, cultural, and, of course, the ramifications for the resources they would need to commandeer. More worlds affected, some of which they had assumed would be safe havens, more people affected. That would mean more ships, which meant more of everything. More of everyone. Grimly, he said,
I have no idea whether we can do this, Rafi.
Sure we can. Think of it this way. Nobody else is going to do it.
He smiled.
All right. I should speak to Geordi, and then to Bordson.
In that order, sir?
When presenting a problem to your superiors, always present your preferred solution.
That's good advice, JL. I'm going to try that on you.
I thought you already did.
He watched her stand and leave.
Oh, could you speak to Coley? Let her know what's going on and ask her to come up with some scenarios for how we handle this. Foremost, where the hell are we now supposed to take all these people?
She gave him two thumbs up.
On it, JL.
Utopia Planitia Shipyards, Mars. LaForge was out on the upper orbit production line when he got the call from the Admiral. He slipped into one of the shuttles to take the call privately.
Shit,
he said, when Picard explained the new estimates for the supernova blast radius.
And before you ask, yes, we are sure of the figures.
Federation data rather than Romulan, huh? We should have seen that coming.
It's going to mean more ships, Geordi, Picard said apologetically.
He should have seen that coming, too.
We're maxed out here, sir. Everything has been turned over to expanding the fleet. The new construction facilities are underway, but there's nothing coming off those lines until we can staff them properly, and that means waiting until Bruce Maddox makes a breakthrough.
LaForge sighed. Maddox's lack of progress and enthusiasm was a concern.
You're usually positive, Geordi. Is there a problem?
The last thing Jean-Luc Picard needed to worry about right now was Bruce Maddox's sense of his own importance.
Oh, the usual problems you associate with pushing the boundaries of advanced synthetic research, sir.
Quite.
But I've got a genius working on it, or so he tells me, and he's been given the lab space he always wanted and the team he always wanted.
Anything else you can do to push him in the direction we need will be most appreciated. We need those ships.
You'll get them, Admiral.
Thank you, Commander. Picard out.
LaForge sat and watched Safadi's new model for the blast radius and whistled through his teeth.
Bruce Maddox, he muttered. I am throwing resources at you. What more do you need?
Then a slow smile crossed his face. Maybe he could send Maddox something special, or rather, someone special. He opened a channel to the complex below.
Put me through to Commander Mackenzie.
When she appeared on the screen, he said, Estella, I have a job for you. Starfleet Command, San Francisco, Earth. Captain Kirsten Clancy was fresh from a meeting with a deputation from Alaris IV,
who wanted to know why the replacement industrial replicators they had been promised were no longer materializing and had not been pleased to hear it was because they had been sent to Romulan space. She was in no mood to hear bad news, but that was all there was. "First check," she said as Picard briefed her and Bordson on Safadi's work and ran through the ramifications.
"With a mission on this scale," Picard said, "we always knew that there would be complications."
"There's complications," said Clancy, "and they're stretching our resources beyond limits." Bordson lifted his hand to stop the inevitable argument getting underway.
"My immediate concern is how the Romulans received this news. Are we assuming that they knew already?"
"My understanding is that it's impossible to tell. Starfleet intelligence will be informing their opposites quietly. Whether they receive any response will have to be seen. I think we should assume that they knew already, but have chosen not to inform us."
"No," said Bordson. "One would hardly tell one's oldest enemies that news."
Clancy was looking through the rest of the briefing. "This space scientist, Safadi, has she published yet? Does she intend to publish?"
"She's agreed to organize a symposium where she will present her work. Starfleet Intelligence have asked her to invite Romulan scientists to the occasion."
"She'll get Tal Shiar."
"I don't think Starfleet Intelligence minded, Kirsten."
Again, Bordson intervened. "We should not interfere with the process of open science. Safadi should and must publish her research. The Romulans can decide for themselves what to do about it." He nodded at Picard. "Clancy and I will discuss if ships can be temporarily reassigned if the call comes. In the meantime, perhaps our engineers might start offering solutions?"
"I shall endeavor to accelerate that process, Victor."
The comm cut. Picard was gone.
"Kirsten," said the CNC, "you are not happy."
She threw her hands up. "You know what worries me. Each time we stretch ourselves a little further, some more cracks begin to show. Eventually, something will give." Institute of Astronomy, Cambridge, Earth. Safadi sent her invitation to Nokim Vritet to speak at her symposium, expecting no response, and indeed, none came. And then, after a week or two, she burst into Durnium's office, crying out, "I don't believe this! Vritet has replied!" He was declining the invitation, citing the impossibility of leaving Romulus at the moment. He was sending two talented young researchers who he hoped would be made welcome. And that was all. "Get this over to Haig at Romulan Affairs straight away," Durnium advised. "He's going to want to know." Moments later, back in her own office, Safadi watched Haig on a comm screen as he pored over the details of the two researchers.
"Nothing on our files, but then that isn't everything."
He glanced at Amal.
"You realize they'll be Tal Shiar?"
"Should I say no?" said Safadi.
"What? No! Invite them! We can get a good look at them."
"Will they be scientists?"
"I hope not," said Haig. "It will be fun watching them try to keep up."
"But what's the point of having them here? What will we learn from them?"
Haig smiled.
"I won't know that," he said, "until I have them right in front of me."
Verity. Rafi, sitting in a meeting with Picard and Coley, had stopped listening some time earlier. She was particularly good at keeping her personal business out of her working life, but her last conversation with Jay had not gone well. It had become clear to him as they spoke that she would not be returning after the promised 6 months. Worse, she was not offering another end date to replace it.
"Your son misses you," Jay said. "If that's not enough to bring you back."
"That isn't fair, Jay. But I can't leave the mission now."
"No?"
"No," she said. "Damn it, Jay, I'm the XO to the mission commander."
"I know. It's a great job, and I'm proud of you.
but nobody's indispensable, Rafi. I hope you don't discover that too late.
They'd tried to make up before having to end the call. Neither of them liked to leave a quarrel unresolved, but the breach was not healed. She didn't think for a moment, though, that they could not heal it. They always had in the past.
He misses you, Rafi. Sometimes he wants Mom.
You seem preoccupied this morning, Rafi, said Picard in a quiet voice. Is there something wrong?
Damn it, she thought.
JL had enough to worry about without his XO turning flaky. With an effort, Rafi turned her mind away from domestic problems and back to galactic problems.
Everything's fine, JL.
She glanced at Coley.
Sorry, both of you. You know how it is some days. I'm all yours now.
Jokan was explaining that there are a number of habitable worlds suitable for refugee relocation that we have not yet considered.
That's great news, said Rafi, and then worried that she'd said it slightly too brightly.
Never mind. Focus on the job at hand.
There's no such thing as great news, Coley said, showing glimpses of a sense of humor that Rafi had never previously suspected of her. There's only mixed news. It's complicated.
Our work seems to consist almost entirely of complications, said Picard. Go on.
The worlds are just beyond the neutral zone, in Federation space.
Oh, said Rafi. And I thought you were going to give us bad news. It's not an option, Jokan, Picard said. The Romulans would never agree to it.
Rafi, staring at the scenario, said, Would they become Federation citizens?
Both Picard and Coley turned to stare at her, and she shrugged.
I'm curious, that's all.
I assume that the usual requirements for long-term residency would apply, said Picard.
What I mean is, would the Romulan authorities allow it? Allow them to apply for Federation citizenship?
Picard turned to Coley. Lieutenant?
There would certainly be numerous complications arising from such a case.
More complications. Picard gave a curt nod. These, at least, are purely hypothetical. We have already traded significant goodwill simply by informing the Romulans that we know about the revised blast radius. Relocating refugees across the neutral zone into Federation space is a step too far. We will work with your other scenarios, Lieutenant Coley, and hope that we soon hear good news from the Daystrom Institute.
He checked the time and rose from his chair.
You must excuse me. Governor Menema has asked for a meeting in advance of our arrival on Arnath. I gather she has some questions about the facilities there. I know nothing beyond what her own government is telling her, but I would prefer to keep her happy before we face the task of disembarking.
After he was gone, Rafi turned to Coley. I'd like to see a more fully worked-through version of that last scenario, if we decide to cross the neutral zone. But you heard what the Admiral said. That can't happen.
Sure, said Rafi.
That's what he says today. But if there's one thing I've learned about Admiral Picard, he would do anything if it meant saving lives.
Coley was puzzled.
But he's so by the book. Everything so carefully done.
He gave up the Enterprise for this mission, said Rafi.
Who knows what else he would do?
She smiled at the other woman.
You're probably right. It might not happen. They'll get the breakthrough at the Daystrom Institute, and we'll have more ships than we know what to do with. This will be a conversation that we will forget we ever had. But I like to be prepared. So let's do the research and have the information tucked away somewhere. And if and when the Admiral finds himself having to choose between a treaty and saving lives, we'll be able to say, Here's what you need to do, JL.
All right, Commander, Coley said.
Does he mind, she went on as they left the room, that you call him J.L.?
Rafi pondered that.
He's never said. Anyway, it gets his attention.
5. Admiral's Log. After the weeks of our journey, our arrival at Arnath was marked by the uncloaking of 8 birds of prey, hardly the most welcoming sight after our long voyage. The vessels in our fleet are primarily people carriers, and while we carry sufficient firepower to defend ourselves, I am not eager to find myself in the middle of battle. However, our conversations with the officer in command here on Arnath, Tholoth, have been, if not cordial, then at least efficient. The first